Hello, you guys, and welcome back to That's Insane, a podcast where I talk about murder, medicine, and maybe more, but most definitely more, because there's a lot of weird shit out there. My name's Aurelia, and I'm one of your hosts. I'm not one of, I am the host. And first, I'm really sorry about the audio last week. Again, I'm still trying to figure out 99% of this shit, and I don't know what's causing like those robot like brrrs noises, and it's really hard to like Google and find out what, like, how do you Google, hey, my podcast is making a bzzz noise? Like, there's nothing that I can find. So if anybody has any idea, please let me know, because I am not really sure what's causing it. But anyway, today I have a medical topic for you. I think this one will end up being a little shorter just because it just is. That's just, I mean, period. So let's just get right into it. And today we're going to be talking about something called fatal insomnia. So fatal insomnia is a rare genetic degenerative brain disorder that's characterized by the inability to sleep and can initially be very mild, but will progressively worsen, and then it can lead to significant like physical and mental deterioration. We've all heard of insomnia. Let me start by saying I heard about this because I saw a TikTok about some guy saying how his insomnia was killing him. And so I kind of like looked further into it, and this is what I found. So people affected might also start developing like autonomic nervous system dysfunction. And the autonomous nervous system is the system that's in charge of performing like involuntary or autonomic body processes, so we don't have to like actively think about doing them. So for example, like regulating your body temperature, sweating, breathing, digesting, regulating the heart rate. Like, I mean, think about all the things that our body just does that if we had to constantly think about doing them, like it simply would not work. All right, so fatal familial insomnia is classified as a transmissible spongiform encephalopathy, aka a prion disease. It's caused by an abnormal variant in the prion-related protein gene, but there are even rarer cases of this disorder that can occur randomly without any abnormality in the gene, and this is called sporadic fatal insomnia. A lot of times when we hear about prions, we think about the acquired disease, which those do exist, but prions also come in like a normal cellular isoform, like the one that I just mentioned here, where it is part of the gene. But prion disorders can have really long incubation periods and then very short clinical duration, which means that you can have it for a really long time without it showing symptoms. But then once it shows symptoms, it's a very short time before it leads to death. So the infection-related prion diseases are ones that are transmissible, and they affect humans and animals. Most humans who acquire prion disease get it from eating the meat of an infected animal. The most common prion disease is the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or what's known as mad cow disease. And actually, up until 2020, the FDA had restrictions on people who lived in Germany, like servicemen or people that were born in Germany or anything, or other parts of Europe between the time of 1980 to 1996, because there was like a mad cow disease epidemic or something to that effect. So literally for like the last 30-40 years, those people couldn't donate blood. I could not particularly find out why, like if it can be passed through the blood or if they just didn't know. I also didn't look that hard into it, because a lot of the like language for this mutation and prions and stuff was in like very smart people language, and I do okay, but I was not in the headspace to sit and read through all of that. So anyway, the PRNP gene regulates the production of the human prion protein, and abnormalities to this gene can lead to the abnormally shaped prion proteins, and that's toxic to the body. Please don't ask me like to really explain that further, because I didn't want to even investigate it further than that. Basically, it makes it a weird shape, and that's not good. So in FFI, the fatal familial insomnia, the abnormal prions build up mostly in the thalamus of the brain, which then leads to the progressive loss of neurons, which are the nerve cells, and this causes symptoms of the disorder. I know we talked about kind of brain parts in a couple episodes back, but the thalamus is responsible mostly for relaying information to the cerebral cortex, which is like the rest of the brain, including like motor and sensory signals, except smell. It doesn't do anything with smell. But it also plays a really large part in regulating sleep, wakefulness, consciousness, alertness, and then learning and memory. So obviously makes quite a bit of sense. So why is sleep so important anyway? So sleep is essential to every body process, and it affects both our physical and our mental functioning the next day. It also affects the ability to fight disease and develop immunity. It affects the metabolism, and it affects the risk of developing chronic diseases. However, we don't fully understand, like we don't have a great grasp on what sleep does for us, but there's several studies that have showed its importance in things like the ones I just mentioned, as well as memory and learning and other vital functions. Researchers have developed a few theories for why we sleep and why our bodies need sleep. So one is the inactivity theory. This is one of the earliest theories of sleep. It's sometimes also called the adaptive or evolutionary theory, and it suggests that inactivity at night is an adaptation that served as a survival function by keeping organisms out of harm's way at times when they could be particularly vulnerable. The theory suggests that animals that were able to stay still and quiet during these episodes of vulnerability had an advantage over other animals that remained active. These animals didn't have like accidents during activities in the dark, for example, and they weren't killed by predators. But through natural selection, this behavioral strategy presumably evolved to become what we now know and recognize as sleep. However, I'm sure as you can all sit there and imagine, a simple counterargument to this theory is that it's always safer to remain conscious in order to like be able to react to emergencies. So it would seem that being unconscious and asleep would never be like a good paramount for safety or anything like that. Another one is the energy conservation theory. One of the strongest factors in natural selection is the competition for an effective utilization of energy resources. So the energy conservation theory suggests that the primary function of sleep is to reduce an individual's energy demand and expenditure during part of the day or night, especially at times when it is least efficient to search for food. So basically, the body like shuts down to prevent it from needing more fuel, if you will. Research has shown that energy metabolism is significantly reduced during sleep by as much as like 10% in humans and even more in other species. For example, both body temperature and caloric demand decrease during sleep as compared to wakefulness, such evidence supports the proposition that one of the primary functions of sleep is to help organisms conserve that energy and resources. And many scientists consider this theory to be related kind of to that inactivity theory. Another theory is the restorative theory, which is another explanation for why sleep is like based on the long-held belief that sleep in some way serves to restore what's lost in the body while we're awake. So it says that sleep provides an opportunity for the body to repair and rejuvenate itself. In recent years, these ideas have gained support from like empirical evidence collected in both human and animal studies. I really hope you can't hear my dogs barking. My landlord is showing the apartment above mine, and there's really just no avoiding the barking at this point. Anyway, the most striking of those studies is that animals deprived entirely of sleep lose all immune function and die in just a matter of weeks. So this is further supported by findings that many of the major restorative functions in the body, like muscle growth, tissue repair, protein synthesis, growth hormone release, etc., occur mostly during sleep, or in some cases only during sleep. Other rejuvenating aspects of sleep are specific to the brain and cognitive functions. So for example, while we're awake, the neurons, which are those nerve cells, in the brain produce adenosine, which is a byproduct of a cell's activity. Here's your biology lesson, folks. The buildup of that adenosine in the brain is thought to be one factor that leads to our perception of being tired. And actually, this like sensation of tiredness is like counteracted by the use of caffeine, because that the caffeine blocks the actions of the adenosine in the brain and keeps us alert. So scientists think that this buildup of adenosine during wakefulness may promote that like feeling of needing to sleep. And as long as we're awake, adenosine accumulates and remains high. During sleep, the body has a chance to like clear the adenosine from the system. And as a result, we feel more alert when we wake up. I never feel that way personally, but I don't know. This is what they're saying. So consistent with the needs to remove buildup of chemicals in the brain, there's recent studies in experimental like or recent experiments, I can't even read, demonstrating that a previously unknown drainage pathway in the brain, now known as the glymphatic system, they like found this, and it's like a network of tunnels, if you will, that surround existing blood vessels and promotes like the clearance of substances from the brain. Its efficiency is enhanced during sleep, and studies have shown that the elimination of toxins through this pathway, such as beta amyloid, which is a protein associated with Alzheimer's disease, they say that this is also reduced with sleep deprivation. I don't know. That's all I have to say about that. Another theory is the synaptic homeostasis theory. This is a more recent theory that sleep is necessary to reduce neural connections or synapses in the brain. So it proposes that like during the day, there's this increase in the number of synapses, and as a result, or like because of daily activity. So if we're allowed to continuously like accumulate this, then the brain would become overloaded. And kind of like the example they gave was like a hard drive on a computer kind of reaching its capacity. And so therefore, it's necessary to get rid of these synapses and strengthen like the essential ones. Supporting this theory are studies showing that there's like a shrinking and an expansion of synapses with sleep and wakefulness in experimental animals. And then the last one is the brain plasticity theory. So one of the most recent and compelling explanations for why we sleep is based on findings that sleep is correlated to changes in the structure and organization of the brain. So this phenomenon known as brain plasticity is not, again, not entirely understood, but it's a connection. Its connection to sleep has several critical implications. So becoming clear, that sleep plays a critical role in brain development in infants and young children. That's why infants spend like 13 to 14 hours sleeping a day, which like same. And about half of that time is spent in REM sleep, which is the stage where dreams occur. A link between sleep and brain plasticity is becoming clear in adults as well. It's seen in the effect that sleep and sleep deprivation have on people's ability to learn and perform a variety of tasks. It's definitely affected by your sleep and quality of sleep. So I know some of that was kind of like weird, but basically they know sleep is important. They just don't know the exact like mechanism of why, if that makes any sense. I also remember reading somewhere like many years ago, I do not remember where I saw this, but I did look it up last night to ensure I hadn't made it up, and I couldn't find like a ton of it, but basically it was saying that this whole like consecutive 8 hours of sleep theory, like that wasn't always what we were doing. Like they have these journals or something from like the 1500s, maybe before, I don't really remember. But basically it was them saying their first sleep and then their second sleep, like how they would do this after their first sleep and this after their second sleep. So it seemed like they would get up for a few hours and then they'd go to sleep for a few hours and they'd get up for a few hours. And basically as like the industrial revolution and stuff happened, and as we became more day versus night, then that changed and we didn't do the intermittent sleep. We just did the longer period. And I think I saw that basically in like the 1900s, that was more solidified with like the working day or something to that effect. So basically we weren't always supposed to or meant to, or we weren't necessarily meant to sleep for these 8 hour stretches. And then again, the 8 hours is kind of subjective. There was also actually a study recently that said women on average need like 9 to 10 hours of sleep, which makes me feel very justified because 8 hours of sleep to me is like nothing. However, sometimes at like 6 hours of sleep, I feel great. It's literally like six or nine or nothing. But I have issues, so there's that. Anyway, so back to the insomnia. So the fatal familial insomnia, the age of onset is pretty much like all over the place. It can happen from age like 13 to 60, and the average age is kind of around 50 years old. The disease affects males and females equally, and then of course the presentation kind of varies from person to person. In general, prion-related diseases are very rare, with like an annual case diagnosis of both the genetic and non-genetic prion diseases being 1 to 1.5 cases per 1 million people per year. So like super rare. I don't even know if it's per year. Oh yeah, annual. Okay, there's that word. So we already kind of talked about some symptoms, but let's kind of get more into it. So the symptoms will start out gradual and then they'll worsen over time. The disorder generally manifests with disordered sleep-wake cycle or insomnia, and then other symptoms can eventually start like profuse sweating, meiosis, which is when you have pinpoint pupils, sudden impotence, the beginning of menopause, neck stiffness, elevated blood pressure, elevated heart rate, all, again, things that are regulated by that autonomic system. People will also kind of report vivid dreams during the limited amount of sleep that they do get. And in the sporadic form, people do also report double vision as a symptom. As the disease progresses, the person will be stuck in this like form of pre-sleep limbo, which is called hypnagogia. Yeah, hypnagogia, which is that like transitional state from wakefulness to sleep. Like, you know, when you like are kind of conscious, but like kind of not, like you can feel yourself fading. And then like, yeah, that would drive me nuts. But basically they will kind of go in and out of that. This is also the time of the sleep cycle when you see people like start to twitch when they're falling asleep. As expected, slowing of the thought processes and attentional disturbances, short-term memory loss can occur. And as the disease or disorder progresses, they enter like a delirium-like state. And for the most part, As the disorder progresses, a delirium-like state will eventually begin. But for the most part, people's intellectual and behavioral capacity stays intact even in late stages of the disease. So I would expect people would kind of have behavior changes. I mean, it does say that people can experience like mood swings, but it doesn't seem to like have a permanent change in behavior. But there are four stages to the disease or disorder. It starts with worsening insomnia that causes panic attacks, paranoia, phobias, and this can last about 4 months. And then people will start to develop hallucinations. The panic attacks become more noticeable, and this stage will last about 5-ish months. Eventually, a complete inability to sleep is followed by rapid weight loss, and this can last for about 3 months. And then finally, the person will become demented and they kind of become like unresponsive or even mute over about a 6-month course, and then death will soon follow. So I've seen that on average, this whole process can take, you know, 4 to 9 months. I don't think it generally goes more than a year, but it's kind of hard to say. The diagnosis is mostly based on symptoms, but other testing can also support the diagnosis, like sleep studies, PET scans, and then through genetic testing if there's a family history of it. But the only true way to diagnose it is through an autopsy of the brain postmortem, kind of like Alzheimer's. Eventually, the person will succumb to the total insomnia, which is called agrypnea excitata. Okay, and leads to death within a few months to a few years, with an average timeline of 6 months to 36 months. Okay, so I was wrong. It can last over a year, but it's still not great, and its quality seems shitty. Sadly, there is no known cure for the disorder, as it's commonly, or which is common in many prion-related disorders and diseases, so palliative care is the mainstay. There's a lot of conflicting evidence over the use of sleeping pills and barbiturates for the treatment of the disease. Some other symptoms of the disease can be treated with medications like clonazepam, which helps with muscle spasms, and then other medications like esopiclone or zolpidem to help with the insomnia. But a lot of these medications don't work long term. I'm really sorry. You can hear my dog. She's like losing her shit that I won't let her in here. But when I let her in here, she barks really loud. So a couple cases. In 1998, there were 40 families known to carry the gene for FFI globally, and the cases were spread all throughout the world and across several races and ethnicities. However, in Basque County in Spain, there were 16 family cases of the mutation seen between 1993 to 2005, which were related to two families who ended up having a common ancestor from the 18th century. As of September 2022, there's only been 37 cases of the sporadic fatal insomnia that's been diagnosed. And like I mentioned, this form of the disorder does not have that gene mutation on the PRNP prion. So, case one. So, in late 1983, an Italian neurologist slash sleep expert, Dr. Ignacio Reuter, received a patient at the hospital's Sleep Institute. The man was only known as Silvano, and he decided in a rare moment of consciousness to be recorded for future studies and to donate his brain for research in hopes of finding a cure. Dr. Reuter ended up referring the case to Professor Elio Lagaresi, who is a well-known sleep expert, who along with his colleagues carried out like a bunch of sleep analysis as Silvano's condition quickly deteriorated. Lagaresi arranged for a postmortem neuropathological examination of the brain to be carried out. And this collaboration of these groups led to the 1986 publication, which first named and described in detail the clinical and histopathological features of FFI. And again, this study was mostly done on that patient named Silvano. At the time, a prion disease wasn't suspected because of the lack of like prion-related histopathology, and frozen brain tissue for more advanced analyses was also like not widely available. But due to the dedication of Dr. Reuter and Silvano's family, more cases were received, leading to the characterization of FFI as a familial prion disease. So basically, this was like maybe the first recorded case. Case number two, in an article published in 2006, Shankine and Montagna wrote of a 52-year-old American man who was able to exceed the average survival time by about a year with different strategies, including like vitamin therapy, meditation, stimulants, hypnotics. They even completed like sensory deprivation in an attempt to induce sleep at night and increase alertness during the day. The patient was even able to write a book and drive like hundreds of miles in this time, but nonetheless, over the course of these trials, the man did succumb to the classic four-stage progression of the illness. Case number three, and the last case, is that in 2011, the first reported case in the Netherlands was of a 57-year-old man of Egyptian descent. The man came in with symptoms of double vision and progressive memory loss. His family also noted that he had become like recently disoriented and paranoid, very confused. And while he tended to fall asleep at random times during the day, he would experience like very vivid dreams, random muscular jerks during normal, like slow wave sleep. I don't know what that means. Basically, he was doing things that weren't normal, like a normal sleep cycle. After about 4 months of these symptoms, he began to have convulsions in his hands, trunk, and lower limbs while he was awake. And this person did die at 58, 7 months after the onset of symptoms. An autopsy revealed mild atrophy of the frontal cortex and moderate atrophy of the thalamus. So the latter is one of the most common signs of FFI. That's all I got for you. That is fatal familial insomnia and or sporadic fatal insomnia. So yeah, isn't that like nutso? I had never heard of this. I mean, it's obviously not very common, but fuck, dude. it sounds horrible and a horrible progression to go through, but that's what I got for you today. All of the sources are in the show notes. I don't have much else to talk about. You can follow, if you have any weird true crime stuff, weird stuff in general, or medical cases, you can send it to thatsinsanepodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Instagram @thatsinsane_pod. I'm also on Facebook @thatsinsanepodcast. And be sure, as always, to rate, review, subscribe, share, tell your friends about it. Don't be stingy. And that's all I got for you. Until next time. Bye.